World Health Organization Infection Control Webinar Series, Epidemiology and Prevention of Bloodstream Infection. Presented on the 16th of March 2010 by Dr. Walter Zing, University of Geneva Hospitals. World Health Organization, First Global Patient Safety Challenge, Clean Care is Safer Care.
Well, let's start with pathogenesis. Well, here you can see a catheter. This is the central venous line going into the vein. This is the skin. Here you have stopcocks and an infusion bag. So what are the sources of intravascular catheter infection? So we can talk about extraluminal pathways, which means pathogens really migrate from the skin along the catheter on the outside in the vein and here producing a biofilm. I will explain later what this is, and finally may provoke a bloodstream infection. Another source comes from intraluminal pathway, which means that from tubes and hops, stopcocks, pathogens migrate intraluminally through the catheter and may provoke an infection from an intraluminal pathway. Of course, if there is an infection elsewhere, such as a pneumonia or a sepsis, a urosepsis for instance, the spread could be hematogenously and pathogens may arise from distant sites and colonize the catheters and finally lead to biofilm and infection. So if you look at those sources of intravascular catheter infection, it is relatively likely or easy to deduce in the form where would be the focuses of prevention of infections. Of course, one focus is at the insertion site. This is, for instance, respecting hygiene measures, aseptic techniques, using a potent disinfection product, and doing dressing changes appropriately. And another focus, of course, is at the level of hops, tubes, and catheters. Of course, this means how to care for catheters, what kind of hops have to be taken, and nurses respecting appropriate procedures and measures when doing catheter care. Let's talk about biofilm. Biofilm formation is a key in the understanding of the pathogenesis of catheter-associated bloodstream infections. So what happens? Here you see a circle of biofilm formation, and we start with planktonic, which means free pathogens in the blood or in the infusion solution, and the first step in biofilm formation is attachment to the surface. This attachment, which is reversible at the beginning, becomes irreversible. There is an aggregation and there is a formation of extracellular matrix produced by the bacteria themselves together with DNA, which is an extreme slimy molecule one found extracellularly and surrounding the bacteria. Furthermore, there is a maturation, which means that pathogens are dividing and there is more formation of extracellular matrix. Finally, when the biofilm has reached maximal thickness, planktonic bacteria may detach from the surface of the biofilm and result in bacteremia. Those bacteremia events may not be continuous, but are intermittent. For biofilm formation, there are various cofactors which are important. Some of those cofactors are fibrinogen and fibronectin. Those molecules are found within blood. And from this, it is already clear that the attachment biofilm formation occurs primarily first on the outside of the catheter and not necessarily on the inside. However, with increasing dwell time of the catheter, such is possible also on the inside. Well, apart from those abundant proteins within the blood, there is calcium and magnesium and iron. Those ions are important for interaction between the proteins and surfaces. Then production of extracellular matrix by the pathogens themselves, DNA as I mentioned before, and stress. In this respect, stress means, for instance, in the study that has looked into that, subinhibitory concentrations of an antibiotic. The formation of protein ladies occurs within seconds of blood contact with a foreign surface. This is absolutely crucial to take in mind, because especially when blood is drawn from the catheter, from the central venous line, it's impossible to prevent the attachment of protein in the internal surface of the catheter. Fibrinogen and Staph aureus adherence is reduced on polyurethane catheters with reduced surface roughness and hydrophilic properties. So this means adherence of proteins and adherence of pathogens depends on the surface of the catheters. So what you can see here in those two figures, on the left-hand side, on the y-axis you have absorbed fibrinogen, on the x-axis you have the soluble fibrinogen, and what you can see here actually is that the more fibrinogen you have in the solution, the more fibrinogen is deposited on the surface. And the position of fibrinogen depends largely on the structure of the catheter surface. And on the right-hand side, it's a similar figure, and this is just, instead of only a graph for fibrinogen, you can see that via fibrinogen, Staph aureus is binding on the surface with increasing amounts of fibrinogen in the solution. On this image you can see a biofilm on the catheter surface here for E. coli, and you can see here this slimy extracellular matrix holding the bacteria together and producing attachment on the surface, and you can imagine that the penetration of antibiotics in this viscous matrix must be limited. And the problem of the pair of this limited penetration of antibiotics and biofilm is that you certainly will find resistance in lower or inner sheets of biofilm due to subinhibitory concentrations of antibiotics. So let's talk about definition. Definitions are important when doing surveillance of catheter-associated bloodstream infections. Most of you may be familiar with the definitions, and the most used definitions today come from the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, and are published. You see the reference below. So in fact, we distinguish between bloodstream infections, which means laboratory confirmed bloodstream infections, and clinical sepsis. Here you can see the definition of the laboratory confirmed bloodstream infection, which means a patient has a recognized pathogen cultured from one or more blood cultures, and the organism cultured from blood is not related to an infection at another site. Alternatively, a patient may be symptomatic, which means he has a fever, has chills, has a hypertension, and signs and symptoms and positive laboratory results are not related to an infection at another site, and common skin contaminants are cultured from two or more blood cultures drawn on separate occasions. So as you will know, that the most important pathogens in bloodstream infections are skin contaminants, especially coagulase negative staphylococci. And of course, as the finding of such pathogens in blood cultures may be false positive, we need just more blood cultures to make sure that those pathogens may really be associated with the catheter infect. So what means separate occasions? So in criteria, two or more blood cultures drawn on separate occasions means that blood from at least two blood draws were collected within 2 days of each other. For instance, blood draws on Monday and Tuesday or Monday and Wednesday would be acceptable for blood cultures drawn on separate occasions, but blood draws on Monday and Thursday would be too far apart in time to meet this criterion. And second, that at least one bottle from each blood draw is reported by the laboratory as having grown the same common skin contaminant organism. So what means the same? Well, sameness also is defined, as you can see here in this table, that for instance Staph epidermidis culture in one culture and you find in the companion culture Staph coagnac, also reported as Staphylococcus epidermidis, or Bacillus species versus Bacillus cereus, or two times Bacillus cereus, so you can see here. Or sameness may also be defined by the antibiogram. You can see here the one isolate and the second isolate, and they just have to be, for instance, sensitive to all drugs for which an antibiogram was made or resistant. Here, for instance, at this example, Staphylococcus epidermidis resistant to oxacillin but sensitive to oxacillin in another isolate. This is the blood culture drawn maybe 2 days later, is different and is not the same. So you can see here, when I go back in this reference indicated here, you find all those necessary definitions. There is a definition of clinical sepsis, but I have to say that the clinical sepsis may be used only to report primary bloodstream infections in neonates and infants. It is not used to report bloodstream infections in adults and children anymore. So just to make it brief, patients below 1 year of age have at least one of the following clinical signs or symptoms with no other recognized cause, such as fever or hypothermia, may have an apnea or bradycardia, and blood culture, blood cultures are not done, or no organisms are detected in blood. No apparent infection is found at another site, and the physician institutes a treatment for sepsis. This makes absolute sense, especially among neonates, because the sensitivity of blood cultures among neonates with having a fever is extremely low, and sometimes, based on the clinical findings, the physicians have to institute an antibiotic treatment despite negative blood cultures. Let's talk about epidemiology. Most findings about the epidemiology of bloodstream infections come from intensive care units. So catheter use and catheter-associated bloodstream infections have been widely studied in ICUs, and as a consequence, most intervention studies also were made in ICUs. Probably the most renowned database among ICU catheter-associated bloodstream infections come from the National Healthcare Safety Network from the US. This is a report updated annually or biannually, and here you can see the findings of the last report issued in 2009. So here on the left-hand side you see the types of location, all critical care units, and here you can see the pooled mean of central line associated bloodstream infections indicated as an incidence density, which means events per 1,000 catheter days. So you can see that most bloodstream infections are found in burn units, followed by trauma ICUs and pediatric cardiothoracic ICUs in this database. But basically, the range is something between 1.4 to 5.5 per 1,000 catheter days in this database, now comprising quite an amount of ICUs participating in this surveillance. There is another interesting database which was initiated by Victor Rosenthal from Argentina. He took basically the definitions of NIS and now switched to the newer definitions used by the NHSN. Here I present you the latest issue of this International Nosocomial Infection Control Consortium. The report was issued now in a recent issue of American Journal of Infection Control. So what you can see overall, when I talked about between 1.4 and 5.5 events per 1,000 catheter days for the United States, you can see here overall you find an incidence density rate of 7.6 per 1,000 catheter days. So basically this is almost 2 to 3 times higher of what you can see in the United States. Well, meanwhile, over 200 ICUs are participating in this consortium, but those ICUs come from Latin America, Asia, Africa, and Europe, so not necessarily ICUs from developed countries. So there is a difference, and actually Victor Rosenthal in a later publication made a direct comparison of the INIC data with the NHSN data, and you can see that for all ICUs except here in this sample for surgical cardiothoracic ICUs, but for all other ICUs the INIC data were a factor 2 to 3, even 4 higher than what is reported from the United States. So the reasons for this is not, are not quite clear, but we can discuss this later when we discuss intervention measures. There are not so many data from Europe on a national level, actually. So there is some data from the United Kingdom, a bit old, meanwhile, so you can see here I noted you to a range between 2.8 and 5.4 per 1,000 patients at risk. It's not even per catheter days. And however, there is a well-working network in Germany producing quite sound data in past years. And in the most recent study published in a peer-reviewed journal, the report is 2.1 per 1,000 catheter days among 300 ICUs. Well, as we have quite good data and sound data from many, many studies and surveillance studies and intervention studies done in the ICUs, there is not so much data from non-ICU settings. However, central lines are found also outside the ICU, and for instance, for the application of antibiotics or the application of parenteral nutrition. So I would like to give you some data from the literature. For instance, in Geneva, we recently published our data obtained from a relatively small database. But you can see here that compared to the rates in the ICU, we found quite important rates outside the ICU of bloodstream infections. For instance, in internal medicine, almost 2 per 1,000 catheter days, or in non-abdominal surgery, 2.4 per 1,000 catheter days. Astonishingly, we found quite a high rate in abdominal surgery, where lines are mainly used for parenteral nutrition. Not as a surprise, I do not show you the data now, but it was no surprise to me to find parenteral nutrition in this database as an independent risk factor for central line-associated bloodstream infection. Another study published by an American group and reporting numbers from four general medicine wards in Missouri found quite high rates, actually. So you see those, then the incidence densities were between 4.3 and up to 8 per 1,000 catheter days, which is quite high, actually. Quite recently, the NHSN started also to report non-ICU numbers. So I would like to give you the most recent numbers as published last year, and you see that for medical surgical non-ICU settings, the numbers are 1.2 per 1,000 catheter days, and the surgical units 1.4. So the medical surgical numbers are quite in line with what we found in our hospital, far below of what Marshall found in his study in Missouri. However, the surgical numbers are well below of what we have found, especially when comparing with general surgery or gastrointestinal surgery, in fact. So let's talk about catheter types. When we talk about risk for infection, there is a difference between catheter types. So in this interesting work by Dennis Mackey and published in 2006, you can see quite nicely the different risks for CLABSI among the different catheter types. So if you go into literature, you find the highest risk among central venous catheters, 2.7 per 1,000 catheter days in this study here, followed by PICCs, those are peripherally inserted central catheters, 2.1 per 1,000 catheter days, followed by tunneled CVCs with 1.6 per 1,000 catheter days. Peripheral venous catheters have a much lower risk. In that study here, or in that, well, actually a systematic review, Dennis Mackey found a rate of 0.5 per 1,000 catheter days, and certainly at the low end are implantable port systems with 0.1 per 1,000 catheter days. However, incidence density is only part of the truth. So, for instance, the difference of incidence densities between CVCs, central venous catheters, and port systems is quite substantial. So you have 2.7 per 1,000 catheter days compared to 0.1 events per 1,000 catheter days. However, in proportions, central venous catheters and port systems are quite similar. So you can see that among all catheters you insert in your patients, you end up having 4.4 central venous catheters with venous catheter-associated bloodstream infection versus 3.6% of the port systems. This is just to show you that finally, for the patient, infections of port systems are certainly important. An interesting aspect also can be found by the comparison of central venous catheters and peripheral lines. So from an incidence density point of view, you can see that there is a difference, again, between the CVCs and the peripheral lines of 2.7 versus 0.5 per 1,000 device days. However, in absolute numbers, peripheral lines may be more implicated in complications than what you would think about. Well, the reason is that we use many, many peripheral lines. That's absolutely crucial to know. I mean, there is almost no patient entering emergency room without having a peripheral line, finally. So you can see that just the amount of device days we create with peripheral lines is extremely high, while the complications with peripheral lines, fortunately, are quite low. So this results in a relative low number of incidence densities. However, for instance, in this publication by Pujol, they easily found similar numbers of catheter-associated bloodstream infections when they looked in their hospital for CVC-associated bloodstream infections and peripheral catheter-associated bloodstream infections. So this is certainly something we have to keep in mind for the future. However, I can tell you there is almost no information in the literature about that. So what is about time to infection? This is certainly something to bear in mind as well. You can see here in this diagram on the left-hand side from ICU settings, we found in a recent study around a median of 5 to 6 days to central line associated bloodstream infections, which after a intervention we could prolong a little bit, while in non-ICU settings, the time to infection is quite prolonged. But, I mean, in general, catheters in the ICU and catheter and central lines outside the ICU are not identical. While the dwell time of catheters in the ICU is much shorter, maybe something between 4 to 6 days median, the dwell time outside the ICU is much longer, maybe something between 8-9 days, up to 14 days in median, depending on the indication of the catheters. Time to infection for non-central venous lines, however, for port systems or tunneled CVCs are much, much longer. There is almost no information in the literature. I found 2 studies reporting time to infection, so we can end up and assuming that for adults, time to infection for port systems is something about 80 days and children about 100 days. So there is not much difference between adults and children in this respect. So what are risk factors for central line associated bloodstream infections? Certainly dwell time. It has been shown long ago that dwell time is a risk factor. The longer a catheter is in place, the more it is at risk for infection. As you can see here in this diagram by Francis Waldvogel, and you can say catheters days in place, you can see the proportion of the catheters causing bacteremia is increasing with time. Insertion site. Well, it has been repeatedly reported that insertion site is a risk factor, with subclavian access as the preferred insertion site for central venous catheters, followed by internal jugular access, and certainly femoral access is more associated with central catheter-associated bloodstream infections. However, there is an interesting study published recently by a French group looking at catheter colonization and central line-associated bloodstream infections among patients in need for hemodialysis, and they could not find a difference. So it is not quite clear why this is. Maybe we can assume that it has something to do with good catheter care. However, this is just to mention that maybe the differences between subclavian excess and internal jugular excess may be smaller than assumed up to date. However, I think when you go to the literature, it still holds to say that subclavian excess and internal jugular excess are still the preferred site for catheter insertion compared to femoral excess. What about lumen? There is an older study, meta-analysis, looking about multi-lumen versus single lumen. You can see here multi-lumen, single lumen, and they end up saying that there is preference for single lumen. So whether this is really associated with a diameter or more, that multi-lumen catheters are more found in the ICU where catheters are more readily used, are more manipulated, all the lumens are used, this needs to be discussed in the future. In my opinion, I would favor the idea that multi-lumen catheters invite to use them more often for more indications than single lumen catheters. So contaminated intravenous products, of course, is a risk. Fortunately, today this plays quite a minor role, although there is some evidence in the literature about smaller and large epidemics with contaminated intravenous products. So not respecting maximal sterile barrier precautions may be a risk. So what are maximal sterile barrier precautions? Using sterile gloves, sterile body gown, face mask, head cap, full-size sterile drape around insertion site while inserting a catheter. You can see here, when you do not use MSB, the risk may increase by relative risk of 2.1 compared with reduction of risk when you use and you comply with the recommendations of maximal sterile barrier precautions. Guide wire exchange, well, there are some older data assuming that guide wire exchange should not be used, so as the use of guide wire for CVC replacement may be a risk factor. So especially when you remove a catheter when in a patient with fever and you think that the patient may have catheter-related bloodstream infection, I think it's absolutely not recommended to exchange the catheter via guide wire. Parenteral nutrition has been repeatedly shown to be a risk factor. I think there are quite numerous studies now published in the literature where parenteral nutrition resulted as an independent risk factor. There is not much information about catheter-related thrombosis as a ground of kind as a niche where infection could be propagated and enhanced. However, it is believed that catheter-related central vein thrombosis may be a risk factor for catheter-associated infection. Whether central vein thrombosis is a frequent complication is not yet clear, as there is not much information about that. So in the literature you find rates of something between 5 to up to 10%, I have to admit, CVCs with thrombosis. Another risk factor which may be not so obvious is composition of nursing staff and workload. So it has been shown that lower regular nurse to patient ratio or higher pool nurse to patient ratio may be a risk factor, may be factors favoring central line associated bloodstream infections. What about povidone, iodine versus chlorhexidine? So the use of chlorhexidine, and the first studies initially were done with a 2% aqueous solution, but most studies thereafter were done with an alcohol, usually isopropylic alcohol-based product. Rather than 10% povidone iodine for cutaneous disinfection before insertion of intravascular device, as well as for post-insertion catheter care, can substantially reduce the incidence of catheter-associated bloodstream infections. So today's recommendation as a consequence of those studies is to use chlorhexidine containing skin antisepsis. Hand hygiene, of course, hand hygiene must be respected. Hand hygiene promotion as has been shown in a study also in Geneva, is effective in reducing the risk of central line-associated bloodstream infections. And we also found something similar when I was working in Zurich. I will present this study later on in this talk. So what are the interventions? What can we do to reduce catheter-associated bloodstream infections? So I would like to distinguish between procedural interventions and technical interventions. So I would like to start with procedural interventions. When you go to the literature and you look for procedures to reduce catheter-associated bloodstream infections, you find always more or less the same procedures. So here I have a list, and the procedures you find are respecting hand hygiene, respecting maximal sterile barrier precautions, the use of chlorhexidine rather than povidone iodine for skin antisepsis, to avoid femoral access, to use a single lumen if possible rather than multi-lumen catheters, to remove catheters as soon as possible, having a good work organization, avoiding guide wire exchange, and not doing a routine catheter change. I would like to start to discuss this landmark paper published by Philip Eckermann and Didier Pitet in The Lancet in 2000, almost 10 years ago. They present the efficacy of a multimodal intervention strategy using education, introducing standardized written processes in the hospital, including the use of maximal sterile barrier precautions, the switch from povidone iodine to chlorhexidine containing skin antisepsis products to enforce hand hygiene compliance and enforce appropriate CVC care. So this study was done in two intensive care units here in Geneva, including 2,000 patients at baseline, 1,000 patients at intervention, accumulating 13,200 patient days in total. So this is a little bit small. I'm not sure whether you can read everything. Well, on this slide, you can see on the left-hand side the guidelines, and on the right-hand side what has been done. So maybe we should nevertheless discuss this briefly. So material preparation before the intervention was based on physicians' individual preferences. The positioning of the patient was done according to nursing habits acquired elsewhere. And this is something extremely important, because I will come back to that later in another study. We are working in large hospitals, and those hospitals, many nurses are working coming from different regions. Here in Geneva, for instance, the majority of nurses working are coming from France, but from other countries as well. In Zurich, in the German part of Switzerland, the majority of nurses are coming from Germany, from all different cities from Germany, and they have their habits. They have their own specifics how to care for a patient, and also how to care for catheters. It does not come as a surprise that those nursing habits, they can be quite substantially different. Line insertion, there were some general institutional recommendations. Skin preparation was done by hair shaving instead of clipping. Skin antisepsis was done with povidone iodine, 10%, or an alcohol-based solution. Barrier precautions, of course, sterile gloves were already used, but the sheets used for catheter insertion were small. And insertion techniques were various techniques, also based on the physician's own experiences, and there was no specific training for ICU physicians. For dressing, there were several types according to individual non-standardized criteria, as I mentioned before, which were more associated with where the nurses made their school and not what was customary in the hospital. The replacement of dressings was done every 24 hours for all dressings, irrespective of the kind of dressing which was used. General handling was based on universal precautions defined by the direction the Board of Nursing. Device removal was recommended as every 3 to 5 days for peripheral lines, and there were no specific recommendations for central lines. And hand hygiene during insertion and catheter care was done by hand washing with surgical soap in sink before and after each patient care or hand disinfection. So the most important intervention of this study was to recommend to introduce new guidelines based on evidence-based recommendations and standardized procedures and having those procedures in written form. So material preparation now was according to a detailed list to avoid interruption during insertion. The position of the patient were recommended to permit an optimum access to insertion site, and the presence of a nurse to assist the physician during catheter insertion was mandatory. For skin preparation, hair cutting was used instead of shaving. For skin antisepsis, an alcohol-based solution of chlorhexidine was used. Barrier precautions were enlarged and the maximal sterile barrier precautions were introduced. For insertion techniques, there was a specific training for ICU physicians, and the subclavian access was promoted and wrist vein for short lines. For dressing, at that time, I have to say, because meanwhile this has changed also with the official CDC recommendations, at that time the occlusive dressings were just too opaque and did not allow transpiration of the insertion site. Replacement was recommended according to the recommendations of the CDC, which meant that every 72 hours for administration sets and devices and every 24 hours for lipid emulsion lines and immediately after the use of blood products. There were recommendations for general handling, how to open a hub, means on an antiseptic impregnated pads after hand disinfection, and new caps had to be used when the hubs were opened. Device removal for peripheral lines after 72 hours systematically, for central lines as clinically indicated without routine replacement, and it was recommended that any device should be removed promptly if not absolutely necessary. And hand hygiene now was done almost exclusively by hand disinfection, which was strongly emphasized before and after any care, and hand washing only for soiled hands and followed by hand disinfection. So with this multimodal intervention strategy, it was possible to decrease the incidence density rate of bloodstream infections overall from 11 per 1,000 catheter days to 3.8, and for microbiologically documented bloodstream infections from 3.1 to 1.2. So you can see this multimodal intervention strategy was highly effective. Later on, Peter Pronovost performed this large multi-center study among ICUs in Michigan. What he did actually is reduce, so to speak, the multimodal intervention strategy to a well-defined bundle. This bundle included hand hygiene, the use of maximal sterile barrier precautions, using chlorhexidine for skin antisepsis, avoiding femoral excisions, and remove needless CVCs whenever possible. So this study was done among 103 intensive care units in Michigan. There were 18 months of follow-up, and for almost 2,000 months accumulated, and including 375,000 CVC days. So you can see this is quite a large study. So what were the findings? So here on this table you can see here the median events per 1,000 central line days, and you can see that they reduced their rates from 7.7 per 1,000 device days to 1.4 per 1,000 device days. When calculating medians from the different ICUs participating in this study, they ended up with even having zero infections. But of course, this is not really zero overall. But nevertheless, I mean, they reduced the central line associated bloodstream infections significantly by introducing this bundle. And I think this study nicely showed that the introduction of a multimodal strategy has a really important impact. I would like to show you a smaller study which has been done in Zurich. This is another prevention strategy, and the intervention of this strategy actually was only looking at improving hand hygiene and improving catheter care. So this study has been done in 5 intensive care units of a large tertiary care university affiliated hospital, and it was a classical baseline intervention before and after study, including over 7,000 CVC days. The reason why I would like to explain this study is the following. Before coming to the results of the study, I would like to point out something very, very important. When you do an intervention, especially when you do a multimodal intervention in a hospital, it is absolutely necessary to have the whole teams on board. So you cannot just walk in the ICU and tell them that from now on we do it like this and you have to do it and end of story. Healthcare workers in the ICU, they must relate to an intervention. They must accept a procedure change, and they must adopt the intervention you're planning to do in your hospital. So what we did actually is, after creating a concept of what we are going to do in the ICUs, we invited the head nurses of the ICUs, we talked to them, we showed to them our interventions, we asked them, well, listen, is this feasible? For instance, the introduction of a non-touch technique in the ICU, is this feasible in everyday life? And then we integrated in our later intervention the ideas of the head nurses and teaching nurses of the ICUs and tailored our intervention according to those recommendations. So this helped us to have the teaching nurses and the head nurses of the ICUs already on board. What we did later is we informed all ICU nurses ex-catheter in colloquiums they have regularly and explained them what we are going to do. And we ended up with performing more than 80 bedside teaching sessions where we went on the ICU and we worked with the nurses how to touch the catheter, how to do a dressing, how to manipulate the tubes and the stopcocks just in order to make sure that they did it correctly. So those are the results. Well, there was an improvement with hand hygiene, especially with performing the hand hygiene correctly. You can see that after the intervention, pre-intervention, post-intervention, before patient contact, after patient contact, in both we have a significant improve of how to do hand hygiene correctly. The overall compliance was, well, compared to international standards and what we find in the literature, quite high already, with 55% before patient contact and 61% after the intervention and almost 70% after patient contact, even pre-intervention. But there was a significant reduction of central line-associated bloodstream infections from 3.9 at baseline to 1 in the intervention period just by improving hand hygiene and improving catheter care. Just here to show you that intervention not only reduced catheter-associated bloodstream infections, but was also a shift of time to infection after improving catheter care. Of course, such intervention studies were not only done in industrialized country, not only in Switzerland, of course, but here a study that has been done in Mexico, and the interventions here were improving catheter care and especially in, enforcing hand hygiene compliance. This study was done in Mexico City in 2 intensive care units. There were 12-month baseline and intervention month, and so over 3,000 catheters were accumulated. So what you can see here is that they started quite high with over 40 central line associated bloodstream infections per 1,000 catheter days. But nevertheless, after organizing education sessions and after teaching healthcare workers how to insert catheters and how to do appropriate catheter care, they halved their incidence density to 19.5 per 1,000 catheter days. Well, still quite high compared to today's standards as published in several national and international networks, but I think this shows that a reduction of central line-associated bloodstream infections is possible also in non-industrialized countries. So what can we set now is that a CDC bundle, just to finish this part of interventions on procedural level, just to recall the bundle once again, the bundle consists of hand hygiene, the use of maximal sterile barrier precaution measures, catheter insertion, use skin and chlorhexidine-containing products for skin antisepsis, use subclavian access rather than jugular and certainly not femoral access, and daily review of line necessity with prompt removal of unnecessary catheters. What are the technical interventions? Of course, you can improve your procedures, and we have seen that using a multimodal strategy already reduces central line-associated bloodstream infections. So, but of course, you are well aware that there are different approaches to reduce catheter-associated bloodstream infections while using coated catheters, for instance. So, just to show you here a meta-analysis that has been published 2 years ago and looking at coated catheters coated with chlorhexidine and silver sulfadiazin, external or external and internal. This is the first generation. Those are the second generation catheters, and minocycline rifampicin coated catheters. Of course, those catheters, by the way, the chlorhexidine silver sulfadiazine and the minocycline rifampicin coated catheters are those catheter types commercially available today. In the literature, you will find other catheters such as chlorhexidine-coated catheters, cefazolin-coated catheters, or vancomycin-coated catheters. There are some newer catheters now released on the market using carbon, silver, platinum carbon coating, or rather impregnating, actually, catheters, or using other techniques in order to improve the release of silver ions from the catheters. Briefly, what can be said at the moment is that chlorhexidine silver sulfadiazin coated catheters, they certainly reduce catheter colonization. They are less effective when it comes to central line-associated bloodstream infections as an outcome parameter, while the antibiotic-coated catheters, usually they perform on both sides in reducing catheter colonization as well as in the reduction of central line-associated bloodstream infections. There are some studies showing that closed systems using collapsible infusion banks are better than using open systems. So what is open system? In this definition here, for instance, on the right-hand side, you have a plastic bottle, and here you can see the syringe penetrating the plastic bottle to air the infusion bag. And here on the left-hand side is a classical glass infusion bottle, and it has been, well, there are some studies assuming that the use of fully collapsible bags and having a closed system, which means there is no direct way between the air and the inside of the bag, that using those systems may be favorable. This is a study, pilot study done by Victor Rosenthal in Argentina, and showing that those closed systems were favorable in his hospital, and it has been shown last year at VCAG in the United States that taken several ICUs from the INIC together, that this closed system may really be advantageous. Well, there is another device quite interesting. It has been shown that the use of a chlorhexidine impregnated sponge, as you can see here, this is the sponge, this is the central venous line going across the sponge in the vein, that the use of those sponges may reduce central line-associated bloodstream infections. This is a study published by Ruschulte from Germany and already shown a significant decrease from 7.2 to 3.8. And last year, there was a landmark publication in JAMA summarizing the result of a multi-center study in France and showing that the use of the chlorhexidine sponge was significantly associated with a reduction of central line-associated bloodstream infections. What's interesting in this study, though, is that they started relatively low. You can see in the control, there were only 1.3 per 1,000 central line-associated bloodstream infections, which is extremely low. And with the use of the sponge, they further reduced the complication rate to 0.4. So interesting technical approaches in the future. I don't want to go too much into detail, but I think I have to at least speak about lock solutions because many people now try to use them to prevent central line-associated bloodstream infections. In the literature, you find the use of taurolidine citrate, ethanol, chelators, or methylene blue. For taurolidine, there are some studies, I found six in the literature, in vitro studies and some in vivo studies. However, the problem is that most of those studies are quite small. The largest study was done in Germany, and they looked for taurolidine in the prevention of infections in port systems and tunneled catheters, and they showed a reduction. However, the overall reductions of bacteremia was not significant, only the reduction with Staph coab neg was significant. And they even had more infections with gram positives. Well, anyway, I think this needs to be confirmed, and I think at the moment we cannot really say that taurolidine is effective. Well, the results are encouraging but not conclusive. A study looking at ethanol LOX found a significant difference between the ethanol group and the control group in tunneled catheters. However, they had extremely many infections among controls, and the study size were quite small. Last year at the ECAG in San Francisco, the group around Dennis Mackey presented their results of using ethanol, and although ethanol may be effective in vitro, results were rather disappointing in this large randomized controlled trial. They had a similar amount of central line-associated bloodstream infections. Maybe it was associated with a short contact time of 1 hour. Maybe if you prolong the contact time from 1 hour to 3 hours, it may be more favorable. Chelators may play a role in the future because, as I explained to you initially, magnesium and calcium are important in biofilm formation. Chelators, which bind those ions, may be interesting in the prevention of biofilm formation and in the prevention of central line associated bloodstream infections. So far, all studies are quite small, and I think there is no conclusion that can be drawn right now. An interesting study that has been shown by Dennis Mackey last year at ECAG was the use of citrate, methylene blue, paraben. Citrate is a chelator, methylene blue is kind of an antiseptic, and paraben is a preservative, and they had quite interesting results in reducing central line associated bloodstream infections from already quite low as well, 0.8 to 0.24. There is another device for needleless systems. This is a lure-activated device coated with silver nanoparticles, and this is interesting on a laboratory level. Clinical studies need to show that this device is effective also in clinical settings. Well, as a summary, the goal still is to have zero central line-associated bloodstream infections. Well, I think how can we get there is relatively clear. It is through multimodal intervention strategies. I think there is no one single intervention which can be held responsible for a reduction of central line associated bloodstream infections, but it is the multimodal approach or bundle approach. But the last mile may require the use of some technical devices, as has been nicely shown with the use of the chlorhexidine patch, or some coated catheters of the now newer generations, or other technical approaches. Well, I think, in my opinion, the most important measures are to have standardized processes of insertion, catheter care, and catheter removal, and those processes have been written. And among those procedures, again, the insertion using maximal cell barrier precautions, improving hand hygiene, avoiding the female insertion site to have a checklist, and having good catheter care with accurate dressings, daily evaluation of CVC and insertion site to have accurate changing of tubes and hubs according to recommendations, and to remove CVCs or other central lines as soon as possible. Well, thank you. Before answering questions, I just want to inform you that the next webinar session is 13th of April about proven strategies to control influenza virus transmission with special focus on H1N1, and this talk will be given by Professor Sito from Hong Kong. Thank you. There are not many questions so far, so I start with a few I have. There is more remark, and absolutely right. I told you that about the clinical sepsis should be used only for small infants and not for adults, and this comment underscores this. CDC has recently removed the clinical sepsis criterion for CLABSIs. So once again, as I think I have mentioned already, that if we do catheter surveillance according to CDC recommendation, clinical sepsis has not been or should not be surveyed. It is true that clinical sepsis, in fact, leaves too much room for interpretation, and furthermore, it is easier to survey to confirm bloodstream infections. There is another question about overall CLABSI. Well, CLABSI means central line-associated bloodstream infections, and the question is whether this would include bloodstream infections from peripheral lines as well. So, well, actually we are talking about bloodstream infections. Those bloodstream infections may be primary or they may be associated with a device. If the device is a central line, then we talk about CLABSI. Then we talk about central line associated bloodstream infections. And then central line associated bloodstream infections is central venous catheters, is peripherally inserted central catheters, those also port systems, tunneled catheters, and some arterial lines, not all, but some arterial lines. For instance, among neonates, also umbilical catheters, venous umbilical or arterial umbilical catheters, those are central lines, okay, CLABSI. On the other hand, of course, it's true that peripheral lines may be responsible for bloodstream infections, but of course, then we talk not about CLABSI, we would say about peripheral line-associated bloodstream infections, but as there is not much literature about that, there is no term which has been well defined in the literature so far. I think I just wanted to make a point here that there are two points I would like to make. One point is that the whole discussion about catheter-associated bloodstream infections has been done or has been or focuses on or has been focused in the ICU, intensive care unit. This makes sense because most central lines, at least, are inserted in the ICU, and most complications are found in the ICU. But it is true, also true, that there are central lines outside the ICU, and we did not really look closely on those catheters. The NHSN has started to observe also catheters now outside the ICU, and I think this is absolutely a good strategy because as we seem to be more successful now in the reduction of bloodstream infections in the ICU, I think this is time now to focus outside the ICU and look and have a closer look what happens in surgical units, in hemodialysis units, and so on. And the other point I would like to make is as well that peripheral line, we neglect completely peripheral lines. We think the peripheral lines is as taking a tablet or changing a dressing. This is something that just is part of everyday life of our patients. And in a way, in fact, this is true. But just because we use this device on an everyday basis does not mean that this device is completely riskless. You don't have the answer right now whether this is a real serious risk. Maybe it's not even worth to talk about it. On the other hand, I think it is worth having a closer look on this kind of peripheral lines as a risk for bloodstream infections. And I think we should just ask ourselves this question whether it might be a problem or not. I mean, from my experience, I can tell you that in Geneva we have sometimes serious bloodstream infections associated with peripheral lines. So it is not something that does not happen at all. So another question, and I apologize for that on my slides. There is some confusion about the term CLABSI or CRBSI. Well, think there is no internationally accepted abbreviation for this kind of infections. Personally, I prefer CLABSI because CLABSI means central line associated bloodstream infections and says exactly what we mean. So again, those catheters going to a central vein, while CRBSI only says catheter-related bloodstream infections, which means that peripheral lines in theory would be part of it, although I have to say that usually they are not part of it. So, but it's true that some studies are in the literature use CLABSI, others use CRBSI, and usually it's the same type of catheters that are included. So there's a more a comment of somebody who is especially impressed by the efficacy of the sponge technique. Well, actually, I can tell you, I was as well. So I think this was probably one of the landmark publication last year in central line associated bloodstream infections, is really to see that a small sponge containing chlorhexidine can have such an impact. And I think this is also not only encouraging because this device is so effective, but I think this should also encourage us to think about that simple intervention techniques can be extremely effective, and not everything that is complicated is necessarily more effective. There's a question up to explain the non-touch technique. Well, actually, the non-touch technique is relatively simple. So when you approach catheter handling, for instance, so when you basically, it doesn't matter whether you work with a stopcock or you work with a needleless connector. It means that you try to respect as much distance to the crucial area as possible, or to the aseptic part of the catheter and the tubing as possible. So for instance, if you work with a stopcock, you do not touch the stopcock, the three-way stopcock, but you take the tubing maybe 5 or 6 centimeters distant from the stopcock, then you open the stopcock and then you make your branch syringe to apply medication or to draw blood or whatever. So it is, shortly said, it is just to respect as much distance to sterile sites as possible. Another question is, what is the role of the Mackie method for central catheter tip culture and peripheral blood sample drawn in diagnosing CLABSI? It's true, I did not go into details. Well, basically, I just gave you the definitions of for bloodstream catheters, central line associated bloodstream infection. But what about diagnosing catheter association? And diagnosing catheter association can be done in several ways. Certainly, if you draw blood from the catheter and at the same time you draw blood from a peripheral line, and then you compare either the time to positivity or you compare the colonies, your colony count, those are probably the gold standards to diagnose the association of a catheter for a bloodstream infection. The problem of time to positivity is that what you find in the literature actually is standardized for coagulase negative staphylococci, and is not necessarily the same when you find a gram negative or when you find candida, for instance. And in respect to the Mackie technique, So this is how to diagnose the association of a catheter using hemoculture. So when you look at the catheter, then it is clear when you look for catheter for colonies and pathogens on the catheter, and those pathogens are the same you find in the blood culture. And the same means that I think it's the sameness is the same definition as I showed you. This means it's the same species, it's the same enterobiogram, then it's very likely that the catheter is involved. And for daily practice, probably this is okay when you use this. Just to make clear, Mackie technique, which is the roll plate technique, and the threshold is 15 colonies, is only one of the methods. There are other methods you can use, like sonication or like vortexing. So this means that you take the catheter, you put it into physiological solution, and you vortex or you sonicate, and then you use a supernatant of this sonicated or vortexed probe and look for colonies, and there the threshold is 100. Just to tell you that there are different techniques for looking for colonies on the catheter. This is a question about the frequency of PICC line dressings. Well, in fact, how frequently the dressing should be changed is recommended by new IDSA and guidelines, and also by the CDC, and depends on the dressing you use. Usually today we use transparent dressings, and those transparent dressings usually should be changed every 7 days. And if you use a non-transparent dressing, gauze for instance, those should be changed between 2 and 3 days. Well, this is a very, well, actually, I like this question, because what about the evidence on neonatal population? And as I'm also a pediatrician, I'm very happy to have this question. Unfortunately, I omitted this, everything that has to do with neonates, because of time constraints. Well, actually, I can tell you that it is different, that neonatal population. First of all, because you have different catheters, you have, in addition to the classical central venous lines, which are rarely used, you have the umbilical catheters, umbilical artery catheters, and umbilical venous catheters. And you have, at least here and in other many neonatologies as well, you use rather PICC lines, with silicone PICC lines, which are in place quite long. So I can tell you that, for instance, in our setting, the PICC lines, median dwell time overall in of our lines is about 4 days, and depends largely on the weight category. For instance, the smaller children, usually they have their lines much longer in place. When you read the NHSN report, you may see that there are weight categories, and they added a new weight category, which means below 750 grams or less. And the risk for central line associated lots of infections is well associated with the birth weight categories, which means then the less birth weight is, the more the neonate is at risk to have a complication. For instance, for the NHSN, those data are something between 2 and 4 per 1,000 line days for the different weight categories. They found 3.7 per 1,000 catheter days for the lightest weight category, which means 750 or less for PICC lines, and 4.7 for umbilical lines. They distinguish also between PICC lines and umbilical lines, which makes absolutely sense in my opinion. So another difference between the neonates and adults is whether clinical sepsis should be included or not. I would like to make this point again, that given the decreased sensitivity of blood cultures among neonates, probably you will have to look for clinical sepsis as well and include this in your surveillance, just in order to make sure that you have quite of a more appropriate perspective. Even knowing that with including clinical sepsis, you would certainly overestimate the true rate of bloodstream infections in this population. But in my opinion, just omitting clinical sepsis in this population would too much underestimate the true rate. And if you do a surveillance, and especially if you are not only interested in what's going on the catheter level, but also what are you doing with the neonates, and what kind of antibiotics do you apply, and do you apply many, many antibiotics, and you should just include clinical sepsis as well. Another question is whether chlorhexidine products can be used safely in pediatric for line insertion. Well, you can use chlorhexidine actually in all children and all infants, but not necessarily in neonates. It is true that chlorhexidine may be toxic on the skin of very low birth weight infants, which means infants of, well, less than 1,500 grams, and because the skin has not matured and is extremely irritable, and you should not use chlorhexidine products in this population. And this is kind of a pity because we cannot use, for instance, the chlorhexidine patch in this population. In fact, there is a lack of technical devices to be used in this population in order to reduce central line-associated bloodstream infections. But we use here in Geneva and in other Swiss hospitals, neonatologists at least, is octenidine, which is another product, and we use that actually with good success. But in term infants and children, actually you may use chlorhexidine products without problem. Okay, I will terminate the session just to remind you again that the next webinar session is 13th of April. And it is about proven strategies to control influenza virus transmission with special focus on H1N1, given by Professor Seto from Hong Kong. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.